Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. You temper all the times, the times I
survive. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
We're back in the saddle at our respective houses again.
Yeah, we haven't gotten down to that face-to-face yet there. It'd be hard to do with a mask on, and I guess, you know, we would start spewing our individual things in the air and it would soon fill up our recording area. So then we could possibly infect the other.
Are you trying to insinuate that I'm full of hot air?
Well, I already knew that. That's one of the qualifications of being a lawyer, isn't it? That's a question on the LSAT, isn't it? Are you full of hot air?
You say no, then you're immediately disqualified.
That's right.
Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Do not collect money tree for your backyard.
That's right. You cannot be one. Do you have scruples or morals? you're eliminated.
I think that's not fair. You know my thought about attorneys and scruples and morals.
Yeah, they're the most moral.
That's right.
They're the most moral that money can buy.
Well, we do have to make money somehow.
Well, there you go, other than the money tree. Well, it's election time, gearing up towards election time. I've already voted. They sent out the absentee ballots, and so I voted mine and sent it back in so that I don't have to actually go there in person.
It seems like it's always election time. Like, is there ever a time when it's not election time?
Oh, no, those crappy ads are always running year-round for something.
They wear me out.
I know. I don't even know who some of these people are. They're not even in here. They're not even from our area. And we get them anyway. I don't know.
I do notice on Facebook a lot of people like to post about different races in different states. It's like, what? Why are you following the District 4 senator's race in Wisconsin? Like,
yeah, what does that mean?
Why are you feeling so strongly about that? I don't quite get that.
But. Well, the one that's getting interesting to me is, you know, we've well documented our Supreme Court troubles in West Virginia, the West Virginia Supreme Court.
That is true.
And those seem to be gearing back up. We've got people that have long since retired from the Supreme Court, and they're running again. They suddenly came out of the woodwork and started running, and they've got a picture in their campaign poster that's like 30 years old. And you think this guy, oh, look, it's a nice young man. Hell, this guy's like 80. And he's using a picture of when he was like 35.
And he actually was one of the youngest justices ever elected.
Yeah, in 1920. but now he's an old codger, and he's got a picture of when he was young. And I think a lot of people, they don't know who they're voting for. You get these, and you don't know who you're voting for. You just see a name. And so you vote for it. And that's the problem. A lot of people don't do their research.
I have a picture of me with him when I was in, I think, fifth or sixth grade. Your mom took me up to the Capitol when I was in fifth or sixth grade and kind of showed me around that place. And I got to meet the Supreme Court justices and Justice Neely in particular, the one you're talking about. And I got a picture of him. And I actually still have it.
Yeah, and he was a member of the AARP then.
Well, I also, he got in a little bit of hot water when I was in high school. I went to a thing called Mountaineer Boy State. It's the, they have boy states in different states. And, you go to camp for a week and you learn about government and things like that.
Yeah. You can run for governor.
Yeah, you can. And, they always have a guest speaker that comes, and, Justice Neely was the one that came up, and he came up and gave a talk. And he told some pretty racy stories to the boys' state assembly, and he got in a lot of trouble about that, telling racy stories to 17-year-olds at an all boys camp.
Well, there's a lot of things that are coming back up as to one of the reasons that he retired in the first place. He was using staff to babysit for his child. He evidently had a child late in life, and he was using staff to babysit for him. And he also made statements like that. Basically, I don't know exactly what the words were, but the short version of it was, a woman's place is in the home, and the world would be better off if they stayed there. And you know, this is a guy, he's coming out of retirement with that kind of reputation, and he's going to save the court. God, the court's had enough problems. We don't need a guy like that back on there.
By all indications, I don't know anything about his statements like that, but he was a pretty intelligent guy and actually a pretty good justice from what I've heard, legally speaking. I can't speak to any other kind of, you know, social issues like that. But
well, being a member of the senior citizens myself, I don't think that we need to be electing more 70 and 80 year olds. I think that they have had their time. That generation has had their time. We need people. We need younger people running the place. Because you can't be progressive when you're that age unless you're Bernie Sanders. Now, he's pretty progressive for a near 80-year-old.
Yeah, he's not a spring chicken either, as they like to say around these here parts.
Yeah, and then you got two other guys that one of the other people running are accusing them of. They're not even real lawyers. They haven't practiced law in forever. They've just been politicians. So yeah, they're slinging mud at them about that. And there's a big back and forth about how many trials they had and had they ever picked a jury and stuff like that. And I mean, I don't know. Nobody ever wants to talk about what they're going to do. They just talk about how bad the other guy was. So yeah, by the time they finish and they've each talked about how bad the other one is, so our choice is now, as the general public, we get to pick between two no-good sumbitches. So we're going to lose whatever. We're screwed. Can you just blank that job?
No wonder.
Save the money?
When you vote, it's the lesser of two evils, because everybody's talking about the evils of people. They're not talking about the virtues of people.
Really? I really don't believe that negative advertising should be allowed at any level. I just think you should be able to talk about, look, here's who I am, here's what I stand for, here's what I've done, or here's what I'm going to do. I don't think you should be able to talk about the other guy, because that's all we get, or how bad the other guy is.
Yeah.
And we never get how good you are. We get how bad the other guy is, and nobody ever gets ahead that way. I mean, you might get ahead for a little while, but it always catches up.
We need to file something ahead of time before these elections, some sort of like motion in limine to limit people from talking negatively about people.
Limine Snickets?
No, motion in limine.
Motion in limine, does that have to do with lemonade?
Nope, it has to do with something you file in court, actually, and it was suggested by Patrick Dieter, one of our listeners on the Facebook page.
Well, he must have some type of law interest if he even knew that term.
Well, motion in limine, it kind of goes kind of a cousin of a motion to suppress, and these are our different pretrial motions.
In West Virginia, that'd be a kissing cousin, huh?
They are definitely kissing cousins, but they are different. So they'd be like third or fourth cousins, probably. The motion in limine.
That's legal to marry them.
Motion in limine, limine is Latin, and it means at the start or at the threshold. And it is a motion that is filed before the trial starts, and it is heard and argued outside the presence of the jury. And the purpose of a motion in limine is to require that certain testimony or evidence is excluded. The reason being is that if it was argued in front of the jury, that it might prejudice the jury or isn't beneficial to the case itself to try to get to the bottom of things. And the judge is the one who makes these decisions about whether or not to grant the motion in limine. So it's not, even though it's something that's used for a jury trial, it's not something the jury decides, it's something the judge decides. Kind of the judge is the one setting the rules.
When the jury's not even in there.
Correct. The jury is not present.
Because you don't want them to even hear the discussion, because it might be something that you, if they heard it, they would say, oh, he's guilty.
And oftentimes when you have a trial coming up, you'll get a trial scheduling order, which will say that all pretrial motions have to be heard by a certain date. So that is when you generally would file your motion to suppress and motion in limine and argue them at that prior hearing before the trial even starts. That way it gives the attorneys a chance to prepare their case and know what evidence they are allowed to bring in, what they're not allowed to bring in.
Well, now, does that happen during discovery?
It happens at the conclusion of discovery, generally. Okay. It could be filed at any time. But generally, the way the order goes is that someone will file a complaint, someone will file an answer, they'll do some discovery, there could be a motion for summary judgment, and then there'll be a discovery cutoff deadline, in addition to a mediation deadline. And once those come and go, then there'll be a final pretrial hearing, which is like the hearing you usually have right before you're going to pick a jury and go to trial. Kind of touch base with the judge and know that, hey, yeah, this thing's actually going to go forward. We're actually going to need a trial, get the jurors in here. And some judges hear those pretrial motions, that pretrial hearing. Other judges want you to set it separately because they can take a little bit of time to argue. But these are motions that are filed and argued generally at the conclusion of discovery, but prior to picking a jury, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, what happens, because you don't always have to have a jury trial, right?
No, you can have a bench trial.
Now, what happens if you have a motion in limine for a bench trial, and then the judge that's doing that is hearing that, then it's going to prejudice him?
Well,
or do you have a different judge do that?
No, it's the same. It would be the same judge. Now, in some instances, you could have kind of a magistrate judge or some sort of a special master appointed to hear discovery issues, and they might rule on something like that. But that's pretty rare. Oftentimes, the same, if you had a bench trial and you filed a motion in limine, the same judge who rules on the motion in limine would be the one who is hearing the evidence and making the decision.
So he's heard what you don't want him to hear, though.
Yeah, but the thought process being is that this person, this judge, has the legal acumen to know that why this has no probative value. And if you convince a judge at a bench trial to throw something out because it should be limited or not come in, it should be excluded, I think that's probably a pretty strong indication that they don't think it should come in.
Hmm. Well, I was thinking maybe it might be because of a technicality or something like that. And so, but if you actually weighed that in with it, it might sway you one way or another. The judge is smart enough, is what you're saying, that jurors are easily swayed and not very smart, so they couldn't make that distinction. But a judge would be able to set that aside and make his decision without weighing that in.
I think so. And it's pretty rare that, generally when you have a trial, most trials are jury trials, I think. Most of your trials where you're going to file a motion in limine and thing like that and go that far forward is going to be a jury trial. You probably wouldn't do that as much in a bench trial just because you wouldn't need to as much. But I definitely would. And I wouldn't really be concerned that the judge is going to be swayed because the judge already ruled on that. So,
well, I think the way I'd look at it, if I were the person that were on trial, if it was something that I felt that high emotion could help me in, I'd want a jury. If I felt it was something that logic would help me in, I'd want a bench trial.
That's one distinction. The other distinction that I see most often is the complexity of the issues. If you have a super, super complex issue, it can be a real problem to try to present that to the jury. Whereas if you present it to a judge, it might be easier because as you're presenting this evidence to the judge might ask questions and get clarification on it as you're moving along. So it's almost like the judge is kind of picking your brain as you go along to clarify things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, that's probably the bigger bright line distinction. Complex matters are generally bench trials, and jury trials are less complex, I would think.
Okay.
So the reason for a motion in limine can be a lot of different ones. The way it usually occurs, though, is probably in a criminal trial, and that's to keep the jury from some sort of information coming in that might be detrimental to the defendant if the jury heard it. And this comes through the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And basically, it is a job of the judge to make a determination about if it kind of this coming in would have some sort of prejudicial effect. And they have to weigh that against its probative value. And those are two key terms whenever you're thinking about evidence: probative value and prejudicial effect.
Mm-hmm. Probative value and prejudicial effect.
Exactly.
Probative.
For example, if somebody had a prior conviction or some sort of crime and they're on trial for something completely unrelated, then you would file a motion in limine to exclude any testimony regarding their prior conviction. The reason being is that prior conviction has no probative value to the case at hand. It does nothing to demonstrate that the person committed this particular crime, and it would be extremely prejudicial to the jury to know this person has already been convicted of a crime.
So just because they were a criminal doesn't mean they'll continue being one, huh?
Exactly. The state would have to prove it, that they committed the crime at this particular instance on this, what they're charged with, not that they've done something previously.
Now, isn't there a problem maybe if you, because you as the defense are going to file this motion in limine, and you've got to describe what it is that you don't want them to talk about. What if you're saying something that they may not be aware of or they don't know about? Aren't you possibly giving them, because you're basically saying this is really worrying us as far as our defense, and if you don't get the motion in limine, you're tipping your hand to the prosecution.
Well, that kind of is contrary to our current theory of how we have discovery and exchange of information in criminal and civil trials. The idea is that discovery, you're supposed to fairly exchange everything you plan on using and everything that's going to try to come in. So prior to motions in limine, there's going to have been disclosures of evidence, and witness lists, exhibits, things like that. So everybody pretty much already has their cards on the table at this point.
Okay, so there's not any surprises that are going to happen.
No. Now, that used to be the thing. Before discovery became part of trials, it used to be just, here's what I say, and here's what I say. All right, let's put the jurors in the box, and let's go. Nobody knew what anybody was going to say. It's called, trial by surprise or trial by ambush. But we've done away with that now, and instead, we have moved to a discovery-based system where we exchange discovery, and we want everyone to be on an equal playing field whenever they are having a trial, so that way there are no surprises and everything is pretty orderly. And that's the one thing that is nice about a motion in limine, is that if you go ahead and get these things, these rules squared away ahead of time, you're not going to have these objections that pop up in front of the jury. And it's going to make for a cleaner record, and it should be a more fair presentation of justice, I would think, because this way you already have a judge who's decided what is going to come in, what is not going to come in, and then it's up to the attorneys to make sure that they don't break that ruling.
Yeah, that's when you have the ones where the judge has to turn to the jury and say, the jury will disregard that.
Yeah,
and that's that statement. Never, yeah, they don't disregard it. They heard it, and it's there.
Yeah, and one of the main purposes of a motion in limine, like I said, is to make sure that there's nice, orderly conduct in the trial. So you don't have these things and have a possible mistrial issue if a jury hears something they're not supposed to.
Well, in the movies, there's always somebody that gets these digs in so that somebody has to be outraged and say, I object. Motion to strike. Motion sustained.
They can also be other things, too. Like if there's a certain, if you know that a prosecutor has a certain trick that they like to do, like maybe they like to walk right up to the jury box and rest on it and put their arms up there and, make an impassioned plea, then you could file a motion in limine to exclude the prosecutor from approaching the jury box within 6 feet.
Really?
You can file anything you want. You can, any kind of motion you want to try to control the courtroom environment, to sequester the jury a certain way, to sequester witnesses, any way you want that trial, any kind of procedural type weird thing you want that trial to be like, that you would file a motion in limine for that.
I would like to file a motion in limine that the jury cannot find my client guilty.
For example, there's a case where a defendant had a offensive tattoo that could not be covered up by normal clothes. So yeah, there was a motion in limine filed to cover that tattoo for trial.
Oh, so what, he had to wear long sleeves or something?
Or if it was on the person's face.
Oh, well, how would you do that?
Makeup.
Oh, makeup or headband or
yeah,
something. Wear a ski mask.
Right. And the reason being is that you would think that possibly that offensive tattoo might inflame the jury and the person would actually not get a fair trial on the actual facts of the case, but they'd be tried rather on their appearance.
So, why is he wearing a ski mask? Well, he was horribly disfigured as a child. It had nothing to do with an offensive tattoo on his face.
Or the ski mask that was worn during the commission of the robbery.
Yeah. If the ski mask don't fit, you must acquit. When I was looking this up so that I would have some kind of idea of what we were talking about, because that was just words to me. I'd never heard this thing. It referred to one of the first things that popped up, and I don't know if you saw this or you have this in your notes, and I'm jumping ahead, was a Buy Low Save Centers v. Glinert. That was a Supreme Court ruling that involved a motion in limine.
I do not have that specific case in my notes, and I do not know the ruling of that.
Well, what I mean, without going into details, just in my layman terms, the evidently like Buy Low Save Centers, they own the building, but they like rent them or whatever to a franchise person.
They buy low and they rent high.
Yeah, that's right. So the Glinert was the one that was renting the place from Buy Low Corporation, and they failed to make several payments on the promissory note that they signed to run the store. And so then they moved in to force them to pay all the promissory note. And somewhere along the line, this thing dragged out in court because it had two rulings in their favor. What they wanted to do, they wanted to suppress the fact that if they went out of business, that the note became fully due. They were arguing they just wanted to pay what they had been behind on, but they wanted the note to stay in effect to draw the terms out, you know, the payments out. But the Buy Low people, they wanted full payment for the entire thing right now.
Yeah.
So one of the provisions in the agreement was if you go out of business, the note becomes fully due.
Right.
But they had filed their motion for payment for violation breaking the promissory note before they went out of business. So they didn't want the jury to hear that they went out of business later, because then they said that would prejudice them against ruling, well, that means the note comes fully due.
Right.
So the two lower courts ruled in their favor that they couldn't say that. And then it finally went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. The Supreme Court denied the motion in limine. But that was one of the first ones that seemed to pop up every time I looked that word up.
And so therefore, the fact that if they went out of business and the note was accelerated, then that came in then.
Right. Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that was admissible, whereas the two lower courts ruled they didn't have to do that. And the Buy Low people felt they were going to not get the judgment they wanted because of that.
The term in the contract that says that if something happens, then everything comes due, that kind of clause is called an acceleration clause.
Acceleration.
Yeah, I just threw that in there just a second ago. So,
to the vanishing point.
Yeah. There can be different reasons for an acceleration clause in a contract. Oftentimes, going out of business is one. Not paying it can actually be one, too. If you don't pay it, then it's accelerated and everything's due at once.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's pretty common language in contracts.
Yeah.
So, one interesting thing, I had never really thought about the distinction between a motion in limine versus a motion to suppress, because they kind of do the same thing. They're attempting to exclude evidence or testimony or things along those lines. But a motion in limine is based generally upon the trial court's discretion about whether or not something is prejudicial or not. Whereas a motion to suppress is based on the court's duty to exclude evidence which has been improperly obtained.
Duty.
So do you see the distinction there?
Yes.
So the suppression is like saying they obtained this illegally or wrongfully, so you need to keep it out. So you don't really have discretion to do it. It's wrong that they did that.
Like they didn't have a warrant for something, right, or something like that.
For example, the fruit of the poisonous tree, like you mentioned.
That's right.
Whereas a motion in limine, you're just saying to the judge, look, judge, this is going to be prejudicial to my client, and it doesn't really serve any value to our trial. But that's not really that's kind of a legal argument, but it's at the judge's discretion about whether or not that they agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Don't you hate it when the judge doesn't agree with you?
Sometimes.
Sometimes? You don't mind if he doesn't agree with you sometimes?
I wouldn't say I hate it.
You love it?
I wouldn't say I love it either.
You got to do one or the other. You can't be neutral.
Sometimes I'm just indifferent. I make an argument, the judge doesn't rule in my favor, and it's just kind of like, well, gave him a shot. let's move on to the next one.
Oh well, it was worth the trip.
So as I said, there's different kinds of examples, but the thing you might be asking the judge to do is to admit into evidence personal information or refuse to admit in any kind of personal information, any kind of medical, criminal, financial records. And the terminology you would use in trying to get this out there is saying that these kinds of documents and records are irrelevant, immaterial, unreliable, unduly prejudicial. The probative value is outweighed by the prejudicial result to the defendant. Or the admittance of such information or evidence would otherwise violate one of the court's rules of evidence. So those are buzzwords. And any motion in limine is going to have those pretty much verbatim buzzwords in there. Prejudicial, probative, outweighed. That's what you look at.
So it's not saying that they were wrong, that the information's wrong, or that they were gotten in an illegal way or anything like that. They're just saying it's not relevant and that you don't need to consider it.
Exactly. Now, there can be times when things that you would think are not relevant actually are relevant.
Well, and I'm sure whichever side of the case you're on, you think that.
For example, in a criminal case, if there is a crime the person, the defendant, is alleged to have committed where it happened at night in a certain area of a park, they were wearing a ski mask, and the person was allegedly robbed at knife point, and they said, give me your money, butthead. You know, they said something like that.
That's rude.
Yeah, it's rude. And so they're arrested and they're charged with that. But lo and behold, this same person 10 years ago was arrested and convicted of robbing somebody in a park at night with a ski mask and a knife and said, give me the money, butthead. So although the fact that this happened in the past doesn't necessarily show that the person did this on this, like the new time, the fact that this is kind of a common thing that they've done before tends to prove that maybe they did act in this inconformity with this same time.
Matches their MO. That's their modus operandi.
Now, if you were a defense attorney, you argue like the Dickens to keep this out, because this is a torpedo in the side of the ship right there. You're going down. So you would definitely file a motion in limine to eliminate that kind of evidence coming in.
Well, I would say that you would, but if I were the prosecutor, I would say, oh, no, we got him.
Yeah. But again, there might be variants to it, too. I mean, the example I gave was obviously spot on the same, but there could be other ones where it's a bit of a closer call. Maybe it's related to it. Maybe it's not. It's going to be up to the judge to decide.
Maybe he said ass hat instead of butt head, and maybe you just kind of ruled it as the same.
There can be other things too. For example, if there was a certain amount of crime scene photo that was just really, really bad, that it might inflame the passions of the jury, that the jury is just going to be so overwhelmed by looking at this picture that they're not going to pay attention to the facts. They're just going to rule based upon the picture. So again, that you say that the picture has no probative value and its prejudicial effect of inflaming the jury outweighs any probative value it might have.
Well, see, that's what I thought took place when we did the story about the West Memphis Three, that they showed the pictures of those little boys that had been killed, just flashed them around to everybody in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And I remember when we watched that, and I said, there is no way that would take place like that. They're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, there should have been some motions in limine about that.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, they could describe what happened without showing pictures, because that would automatically inflame the jury, I would think.
Now, if a motion in limine is granted and the judge rules to exclude the evidence, then that evidence and testimony is prohibited from coming in while the jury is there, unless there is something else that happens that kind of opens the door. For example, if you file a motion in limine to get something out, but then you yourself bring up the testimony and bring it in yourself, you've kind of shot yourself in the foot.
You open the door.
And that means that probably the other side could bring it in now too, and your motion in limine filed is pretty much void. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
So that's one thing that happens a lot of times too, is there's arguments saying, well, they opened the door for this. They opened the door for it. So
I've heard those in movies too, where here's what we'll do. We'll go along these lines, and if he mentions this, then we got him.
Yep, pretty much. Now, if the evidence does come in, and so basically the door hasn't been opened and the other side brings it in and they weren't supposed to, then immediately you would make an objection, approach the bench, and ask the judge for a mistrial. Because you say, judge, they weren't supposed to do this. They presented this in front of the jury. I'm moving for a mistrial. And if the judge agrees with you and says that a mistrial is declared, that's the end of the trial. The jury's discharged. And depending on the reason, there may be another trial, or maybe everything's dismissed. It just depends. But the important thing about making these mistrial motions is that you create a bit of a record. So that way, if you do have to appeal it, if the ruling doesn't go in your favor, you have grounds to make your appeal on, because you could say, well, the judge should have ruled this a mistrial because they breached the order on the motion in limine. So I know, you know, you would think like making a motion for a mistrial is kind of a big deal and it hardly ever happens. I mean, I've had jury trials where I've made like, you know, 10 motions for mistrials just because of what was said or what came in. And I'm trying to create, to make sure that there's a record. Did I really want the judge to declare a mistrial? No, but I still had to make the motion. So,
but you don't automatically get your motion in limine should they charge you again. I mean, should they go ahead and hold the next trial? I mean, they mistrial that one, then they start over, and then you don't get your motion in limine perhaps on the next one, huh?
No, you probably would.
You probably would. Is that it? Doesn't become like common law, huh?
Well, there's something similar to that. It's like the rule of the case. If there's already been rulings in a case about certain things,
then they try to stick with them.
They stick with them, yeah. And you can you can argue almost that the court's already ruled on this issue, so it should stand.
That's what I was wondering. Is if you were the prosecutor, would you want to do that and get a mistrial if maybe you got an unfavorable ruling on the motion in limine and you think another judge would give you a better ruling on it so you could get the evidence in?
That would be a possibility, but it probably wouldn't go to a different judge. It would probably just be in the same court.
Oh, well, that would do you no good.
Yeah, unless you knew that judge was retiring or something and this was that judge's last trial or something, maybe. I don't know. But for the most part...
Unless you're going to try to bribe him this time.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea.
It's never a good idea if you get caught.
So the key thing to remember about the motion in limine and the motion to suppress is that these are motions which are made outside the presence of the jury. That's just to make sure that the jury is not improperly influenced by any kind of evidence that's not relevant. And relevance is kind of one of the most important things the court's going to look at. And in common law, when we talk about relevance, the issue is, does the evidence prove or disprove one of the legal elements of the case, or does it have probative value to make one of the elements of the case likelier or not? So, do you understand that, what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, probative, and that it's not prejudicial.
That's right. And that it's relevant.
So, yes.
And by relevant, meaning that it goes to the issues in the case.
Yeah, it doesn't have any, if it just is something to go to character or something, if you're just trying to disparage the person, the suspect or whatever, instead of actually talking about what this trial is about, then that's not the purpose.
Right. And it has to be probative. And probative means tending to prove and seeking the truth. So if something is not probative, it doesn't really prove what the elements are, and it doesn't help you get to the bottom of it or seek the truth.
Okay.
So now these are governed generally by the federal rules of evidence, and each state has its own rules of evidence as well. And this is kind of where this whole area is laid out. The federal rule is Rule 401 and reads that relevant evidence means evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence.
Hmm.
So it's funny when you read these things, it seems like, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, they said some people get themselves in trouble with the court, lawyers, when they file a motion in limine, and it basically is outlining those rules of the court. And they're not really talking about any particular evidence, but they're kind of like saying, we're afraid that the other side is going to do something that violates this, so we're filing a motion in limine that they don't. And the court, they said, gets very upset when you file a motion that is basically telling them they need to follow the rules of the court.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. At the same time, I don't see anything really wrong with, if you have a legitimate concern that that's going to happen, to bring that to the court's attention.
Well, I guess they just figure everybody's supposed to play by the rules.
I would do it.
Have you ever heard of, now when I saw this, I misinterpreted what they were saying, offensive use of motions in limine?
What, to get something in?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen people use that before.
Well, when I saw offensive use of motions in limine, I thought it was like, screw you, we don't want your evidence, you know. They were being offensive about it. But yeah, what it meant was is that in the example they gave, it said these two lawyers had a case, and it had to do with a domestic violence case where it was actually the wife that had a prior conviction for domestic violence. And the way she did it was kind of like the situation you were talking about. What she did to her first husband was basically what she had done to the second husband. So
she was alleged to have done to the second husband.
Right. So they were wanting to get this evidence in about the first one because it matched pretty much what the second husband was saying happened.
Yeah.
But in whatever state they were in, there was a 10-year statute of limitations to bring these things up. And while the trial was not going to take place until like a week or two after that 10-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. So they filed a motion in limine to admit that evidence now so that they didn't have to worry about that being discarded for being too old when the trial came around. And they said that the lawyer they were going up against was an older, very well-respected lawyer that they often even referred cases to when they felt like they needed somebody with more expertise. Mm-hmm. And the answer they got back from that lawyer is, you can't file a motion in limine to get stuff in. It's only to exclude stuff. You all don't know what you're talking about. Well, and the old guy was wrong.
Yeah. Well, there's a other thing too, like 404B evidence, which is essentially a motion in limine, an offensive motion in limine, like you're talking about. And that is to get in, like prior acts and things like that. So if you file a motion to include 404B evidence, then really that is kind of like a motion in limine to include things that would otherwise probably not be admissible. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. He had just looked at it like, say, to exclude stuff you didn't want to come out. And apparently he wasn't even aware that you could use a motion in limine to include stuff that you wanted to bring in that might for some reason otherwise be excluded.
Yeah, and again, the motion in limine does not mean limit, because it seems like that would be a perfect, you know, cognitive type thing. Limine, limit, doesn't necessarily mean that.
It means threshold.
It means threshold, and what you're asking the court to do is to kind of make a decision ahead of time at the outset about how the trial is going to proceed and not have these surprise things that pop up, mm-hmm. So... that's the purpose of it.
I thought it was offensive. When it said offensive use of it, I thought, what did they do? Insult somebody by filing the motion? They were offensive with it? I didn't know think of it as offense, like defense and offense.
Yeah. I did make a motion one time, or actually it was an objection, because the opposing counsel was getting up in my witness's face, like on the witness stand, getting too close. So I think I said, objection, Your Honor. Said, Mr. So-and-so is in the personal space of my client and badgering them. Could you please direct him to stand back?
Social distance. Would you social distance the lawyer?
So, you know, if I had another trial with that attorney, then I might file a motion in limine to direct so-and-so to not cross-examine the witness 2 feet from their face.
Don't come within 6 feet of my client and wear a mask.
Yeah. So, yeah, but you can file motions in limine for all kinds of stuff.
Huh. Not just evidence, huh?
Not just evidence. Any kind of thing. Any kind of courtroom type situation that might pop up.
All right. I will keep that in mind.
Keep that in mind next time you're getting ready to file one.
Yeah. All I could think of when I read that motion in limine, that's limine snickets. That's all I could think of.
Yeah. a series of unfortunate events.
Yeah.
Which is usually what leads to most people's interplay with the court system.
I do like lemony cakes or lemony pies as well.
Like lemony urinal cakes or?
No, not urinal cakes.
Oh.
Like pound cakes.
Hmm. Okay. That sounds delightful, Tommy.
It is. Not urinal cakes. Why would you think urinal cakes? Those might be lemony looking, but they're not lemony tasted. And that is offensive. That's an offensive use of in lemony.
I do not know what urinal cakes taste like.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal briefs.
Legal briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about some of the terms we talked about. And we got a whole bunch to choose from today.
Oh, man.
What does lemony mean?
Lemony means threshold.
That's right.
You want to cut it off right at the start. Don't even let that stuff in the door.
And that's why you would file a motion in limine to have the judge rule on that before
it gets before the jury could hear it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between a motion in limine and a motion to suppress?
A motion to suppress usually has to do with evidence you feel is ill-gotten or not proper, whereas a motion in limine is... It may be correct or whatever, but for some reason you don't think that it has probative value and it may be prejudicial.
Exactly. And what does probative mean?
Probative means you can probe it real good and see if it has any value as to the case and will help determine whether the person is guilty or innocent.
Well, it actually means tending to prove. So... You're dancing around the right answer there, but you're not quite on it. So
I'm dancing around the urinal cake.
That's right. So if something is probative, that means that it is evidence that tends to prove one of the elements of the case.
Okay.
So
if an alien is probative, then they probe you with their finger when they have you up in their spacecraft before they let you go. They wipe your mind.
What is a mistrial?
A mistrial means that you just end the trial right there, and it doesn't mean you get to go free. It just means that trial is null and void for whatever reason. Like maybe somebody filed a motion in limine, and it was accepted, and then the prosecutor said something anyway that he wasn't supposed to say, so then you jump up and say, I declare a mistrial. And so then everybody goes home.
That, as the attorney, you would jump up and say that?
Yes.
No, wrong.
As an attorney, you say, I move for a mistrial. And then the judge says, granted.
You would say, objection, Your Honor, may we approach? And then you quietly, outside the presence of the jury, say, Your Honor, I'm making a motion for a mistrial. Counsel talked about so-and-so and this, and this was clearly outlined in the motion in limine. That's something we were not talking about. Then they would say, but Your Honor... They opened the door by saying this, this, and this. And then you would say, no, I didn't. They didn't, da, da, da. So, okay, I'm done with my little story, but.
I would just jump up and go, booyah, move for the mistrial, booyah.
All right, the last question. This is a bonus question. I was talking about, we were talking about offensive motions in limine. I said that has to do with a certain kind of evidence, and I gave a number and a letter.
Is like 402B.
Close, 404B.
404B.
And 404B.
I was probably on the same page.
It relates to the federal rules of evidence, and that is crimes, wrongs, or other acts. And those are, that's something that otherwise probably wouldn't normally come in, but you have a reason to bring it in.
Crimes, wrongs, and other acts. I think I had that class in college.
And as a double bonus question.
A double bonus, oh no.
In contract law, what is the name of a clause called when everything comes due?
An acceleration clause.
That's right. That is a standard clause in a lot of contracts that if something happens, then all the payments are essentially accelerated and become due at that point.
Acceleration clause drives all the race cars around at the North Pole. All the little go-karts are making for the kids.
Your clause jokes are limitless.
They're in limine.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought are volunteer virus takers. I know, that's really a mouthful, isn't it? Volunteer virus takers. The other day, I was reading an article, and it said, last step in vaccine approval is, of course, testing it on humans. The problem is that step takes a long time, and it's because we don't infect the humans with the disease we're trying to develop the vaccine against because, well, that would just be plain unethical. So we don't do it. So what we do is we give them the vaccine after it's been through the first two phases and reached that level. We give them the vaccine. We see that it's produced the antibodies. Then we just turn them loose in the general public and just tell them, you know, don't worry about wearing a mask or anything like that because we're hoping you'll become exposed to the virus. Then we'll see if the vaccine worked. Now, of course, these people are all closely monitored. They don't just turn them loose and they're on their own. They're closely monitored with regular checkups and things like that. But you have to wait and see if they actually come in contact with the virus because you don't really know. However, there are calls for what they call a challenge test. A challenge test means you give the person the vaccine, you check and see the antibodies are developed, then you directly infect them with the virus to see if it's going to work. That way, it cuts down on the probability because it's for sure. If you infect them, they for sure got it. So then you can find out sooner with these human challenge tests. Now, the problem is with these human challenge tests, they're not ethical, according to our medical people, because they don't want to directly infect somebody. You never know what might happen, even though they say that young people, for the most part, that the effects are not that serious. They could be. But what happens when people volunteer for it? Now, they talked about paying people for it, but at the same time, they don't want people to do something they wouldn't ordinarily do just for the sake of money. So they said for sure, you know, their medical care should be taken care of and they should be followed up with at no charge and they should get something for their trouble. But it can't be an amount so much that it would entice you to do something you wouldn't ordinarily do. So that's a real fine line because everybody's got their price. Some people are just cheaper than others. However, there is a group that started signing people up to volunteer, and they were looking for people between the ages of 20 and 45 and having no underlying conditions that could cause problems. Right now, they have 24,000 people that have signed up as volunteers for these human challenge tests. That's how bad we want this virus gone. There are people that are willing to say, look, give me the vaccine. Give me the virus. Let's see if this works. If it does, then we're going to save a lot of lives. The name of this group is One Day Sooner. The reason they call it that is because they're saying that maybe 1,000 people a day are dying from this. So if we just save one day off of this development of this vaccine going out, we're saving 1,000 lives. their whole push is to get this done as soon as possible. And of course, if we save 30 days, that's 30,000 lives. So right now they have this group out there that's willing to do it. They have people at that point with several different vaccines that are ready to be tested at that point. The question is, will the twain meet? And will we overcome this ethical question of letting volunteers take this human challenge to develop a vaccine to save us all so that we can all return to normal? This has been Tommy's Random Thought.